Our next speaker before we go to break is Nicola Davis, who is a passionate enthusiast for good quality non-fiction writing, and indeed is the writer of many of the books that have been mentioned today. I would say very quickly, while I remember, that there is a book list, if you didn't pick it up, of all the books that have been mentioned by presenters and workshop leaders today, and Bookshop have been asked to bring those along. But anyway, I can think of nobody that fills me with more passion and inspiration than Nicola Davis when she gets talking about non-fiction reading and writing. So I'd like you to give her a very warm welcome.
Great, that's lovely. Now I'm just hoping you can all keep your legs crossed for a little bit longer. You all right? Manage without going to the loo or getting another caffeine hit for just a bit longer. My very beloved publishers, and I'm not just saying that because I'm here today, Walker Books, have offices on the south side of the Thames, just over from Tate Britain. So quite often when I go there, I get off or stop early, because I'm coming from Paddington, usually I live in Devon, and I walk very slowly over Vauxhall Bridge, and I look down at the river. And I don't know if you ever looked at the Thames, but it's a little slice of the wild right in the middle of London. And being a country girl at heart, I need that little bit of the wild when I'm in London to make me feel like I kind of belong here. So I usually see, you know, a cormorant, a couple of ducks. I've seen a heron a couple of times as well. And as I'm looking down at the water and looking down at those wild birds, that bit of wilderness, I've got a little commentary running in my head. And the commentary that's running in my head is actually one of the most wonderful pieces of non-fiction in the English language, and I'm going to read it to you. I do know it by heart, but I probably won't be able to say it by heart, I'm nervous. Earth has not anything to show more fair. Dull would he be of soul who could pass by a sight so touching in its majesty. This city now doth like a garment wear the beauty of the morning, silent, bare, ships, towers, domes, theatres, and temples lie open unto the fields and to the sky, all bright and glittering in a smokeless air. Never did the sun more beautifully seek in his first splendour valley, rock, or hill. Ne'er saw I, never felt a calm so deep. The river glideth at his own sweet will. Dear God, and all that mighty heart was lying still. Now, I'm sure we all learned that at O-level, didn't we? Wordsworth's on Westminster Bridge. Now, I know a Wordsworth poem isn't usually labelled as non-fiction, but actually that's what it is. It's a piece of observational non-fiction. It's the word equivalent of a Ruskin drawing from life. And it delivers very precise visual information. And it delivers it with a big emotional hit. In other words, it engages your heart and your mind. Now, I'm not talking about engagement in a Jane Austen-y sort of way. Oh, my companion was so engaging at dinner. I'm talking about Jeremy Clarkson, Blow the Knickers Off a Nun at 50 Paces engagement. The kind of engagement where you get cogs and gears and things clicking together to create forward motion. Now, engagement like that at those two very important levels, intellectual and emotional, is where the very best kind of learning happens. The kind of learning where you can feel your brain fizzing, where you can feel your synaptic connections getting more complicated. Now, that kind of synaptic fizz is very, very important in non-fiction, very, very important in learning. Wordsworth had a pretty easy job of it in writing Westminster Bridge. All he had to do was communicate an image and a feeling to an audience of adults. So how do you deliver that double whammy of fact and feeling, that synaptic fizz, when you're dealing with much more complicated subjects and you're delivering them to much younger people? Well, here's how it's done. Now, if you could bring up the cover of T-Rex. This is Viv's absolutely wonderful, marvellous, funny book. And it's about Tyrannosaurus Rex, as you can see. But to say that it's about T-Rex is only kind of true, because what this book is really about is something much bigger even than a 6-metre dinosaur and considerably more subtle. This book is really about the nature of science. Here's how it begins. Can I have the next slide, please? It begins with a conversation between an adult and a child. It began with an egg. What size was the egg? The egg was as big as your head, perhaps. Don't you know? Why don't you know? It was millions and millions of years ago. Now you can imagine how that lovely repetition, don't you know, why don't you know, it was millions and millions of years ago, works in a classroom of children. They absolutely love it. But in that very simple repetition, they're actually absorbing something very, very interesting about science. All the way through the book, the evidence from T-Rex fossils is presented with great warmth and great humour. What we can use to form theories is presented, and what we don't know is presented. Now, that is a really, really important, fundamental feature of the scientific process. Scientific knowledge is not a finished product. It's not a closed box. It's a process. It's a series of ideas that are constantly modified by new discoveries. And that's exactly what that very, very apparently simple but marvellously clever text of Gibbs is doing. And very best of all, it shows the reader that they could make these discoveries. On the very last page, what we have is, as you'll see, maybe one day we'll really know. Maybe we'll know what's really true. The person to tell us just might be you. How wonderful. The child is included in this process. This isn't knowledge being handed down from the mountain. This is a world that they can be part of. Now, this is one of mine. This is That Loves the Night comes next. And this process of presenting complicated information for younger children. You wouldn't think that the nature of the scientific process was something that could be presented for a six-year-old audience. But it works in Viv's book because she's absolutely down there with her readers. She's looking through their eyes and she's asking the right questions. And the T-Rex book shows that if you wiggle your way down inside the world of your readers, you can explain almost anything in a way they'd understand. You can use the images, the objects, the features of the child's own familiar world to explain what's out there in the bigger universe. Now, that doesn't mean dumbing down. It certainly doesn't mean glossing over complicated material, but it may mean not telling the whole story. I'm just going to take a slight detour here into the word special. I would argue that particularly in books for young children explaining science, the word special is the refuge of the author who really can't work out how to explain this. As in, octopuses have special skin that helps them to change colour. You know, I really can't be asked to think about how to explain this to you, so I'm going to give you this word that actually excludes you. Now, you know, I put my hand up, I've used it, I've said special when I've been really at my wit's end and I can't think of a way of doing it. But that is glossing over. That's excluding children. And actually, if you really, really think about almost anything complicated, you can package it in a way that they'll understand, which is why I've got this Bat Loves the Night thing. Now, I did my PhD thesis, but I never wrote up, on bats. So I knew entirely too much about bats when I came to write this. And I certainly knew way, way too much about echolocation, which I wanted to include in the book. You know, bat echolocation is fabulously complex. They make use of frequency modulation and Doppler effect and things that make my brain hurt. And there was no way I was going to be able to put that into 20 words for the consumption of six-year-olds. So for ages when I was writing this section of the book, I was absolutely stuck. But then I realised something really, really important, something that my editor at Walker Books, Lucy, is always, always reminding me of, actually, that my readers didn't need all that complexity yet. All they needed was the information that was new to them. The fact that bats hear their way around. Very simple. So here's what I wrote. Thank you. Bat shouts as she flies. Louder than a hammer blow, higher than a squeak. She beams her voice around her like a torch. The echoes come singing back. They carry a sound picture of all her voice has touched. Now, that isn't the whole story, but it's true and it's accurate. And it lays the kind of right foundation in the same way that T. Rex book does, and many others in that series. It lays the right foundation for later learning. It gives the readers an atmosphere of what is going on during that very complicated process of echolocation. It gives them, I hope, a feel for the subject, a sense of excitement, and a sense of a door opening that they can choose to go through when they're ready and find out more. Now, I need another little detour here to make more of this important thing to remember when you're writing non-fiction, that even the simplest information is new and valuable when you're a little person who's new in the world. One of the things I give my MA writing students to do when they first start and they arrive at the beginning of the year, poor little victims, is I get them to write some non-fiction for very small children. And one of my students here before last came up with this lovely piece about walking on a beach, and it had all sorts of things, it had seaweed and shells and the waves and the cliffs. And in writing this great, it's quite long, quite complicated, very beautifully written piece, she went straight past the thing that would have been most interesting, I think, to a three-year-old. When you walk on a sandy beach in bare feet, you leave an imprint. Can you remember when you were very little, putting your foot in mud or in sand, and you take your foot away, and there's your foot, and it's little, and there's daddy's foot, big, beside you, or mummy's foot, or your big brother, or the dog's foot. That is absolutely fascinating information, and it's got all sorts of kind of underlying subtleties to it as well, and actually that's what I drew her attention to, and then she went away and expanded that little bit, that moment of discovery for a 3 or 4 year old child, and actually wrote a very, very nice piece. But it is really, really important to remember that, and it's something I have to remind myself all the time, that for people who are new in the world, the simplest thing can count as non-fiction information, and the unpacking of that emotionally and intellectually can be really important. Okay, so by putting together complicated facts with feelings, you can get them over to this audience of young children. But what about complicated feelings? Complicated feelings surely are the territory of the novel. Well, to a certain extent I'd agree with that really, but I think when you've got really difficult, really complicated feelings, Dobby the house elf isn't really going to cut the mustard. So next we have Michael Rosen's book. This is, I don't know if you know this book, the Sad Book, I'm sure many of you do. It's simple, it's direct, it's completely honest, and it's completely true. This book, I was talking about opening doors into knowledge, this book opens other sorts of doors. It shows children that they aren't alone, or they aren't weird for feeling sad sometimes. This is the first page. This is me being sad. Maybe you think I'm being happy in this picture. Really, I'm being sad. But pretending I'm being happy. I'm doing that because I think people won't like me if I look sad. Now, this is the antithesis of the world adults mostly choose to portray to children. The world of children's fiction, where everything works out all right in the end. The Sad Book is about real grief and real loss that don't work all right in the end. They're not dressed up pretty, but they're how they truly are. Where is sad? Sad is anywhere. It comes along and finds you. When is sad? Sad is any time. It comes along and finds you. Now, I think this book is probably doing something in two ways. It's very, very important. First of all, just through reading it, it's opening up things, it's showing readers that they aren't alone. But also, it's offering readers a license to express their own feelings and their own experiences through their own words. Now, of course, all writing potentially offers you that license as a reader. But fiction can be intimidating. You've got characters to invent and plot and, oh, it's, you know, you can get serious kind of fiction, invention, anxiety. But with non-fiction, that's not the case. You write what you see, what you know. So the connection between the words and the world is very clear and direct and honest. Here's the world, here are the words, and there they are going into my brain. It's a really nice straight line. And it makes it much easier for children who are you know, not natural story makers to actually find their voice, because they can go, well, here's my world, and here's what it looks like in my brain, and I can put it into my words, so it's out there in the world again. And I've seen this working so many times, working with children, getting them to look, to really, really look, and then to write just what they see and what they experience. And reading non-fiction gives them the license to do that, shows them that it's possible, shows them how it's possible. To write from the evidence of their senses, from the evidence of their experience, without the pressure of having to make anything up. Now, I was working, I do a lot of work with Farms for City Children, which is an organisation started by Michael Moore Purgo. I'm quite often writer in residence, and I go and I, you know, it's an absolute dream. I get to troll around on a farm with lots of animals and kids. Bliss. And then they write about it. Even more bliss. And one little boy, who was definitely one of the minorities that Jonathan was talking about, he was being a right little wotsit, actually. He was being a real pain and mucking about and just doing what they do sometimes. And I sat him down and I got him to talk about why he was being disruptive. And he said, it's because the dogs remind me of my dog. And I started to cry. So we sat in the orchard and he told me the story. And it's got a quality about it which really reminds me of Michael Rosen's book. I'm just going to read it to you. Bruno was my dog in Jamaica. He was really my father's dog, but my father left Bruno with me and my grandma. Bruno had short golden brown fur. He could make one ear go up and one ear go down. I was about 3 when I met Bruno, and he was still a puppy. In the morning at the weekend, he would jump all over me. His favourite game was running after lizards. The only time he would run with me was when I had a piece of chicken for him to eat. He always followed my grandma everywhere, but he never went into the house. Usually, when Gran and me went out, Bruno would wait for us, lying down on the veranda with his paws crossed. But one day we came back from my auntie's house, and Bruno wasn't there. Me and Grandma called out, but he didn't come. We thought he'd be home in the morning, but he wasn't. We looked out from the veranda to see if we could see him, but he wasn't anywhere. I never saw him again, and then I came to live in England. Very simple, and that all came out just like that in the space of about 5 or 10 minutes, with him saying what he wanted to say and me scribing for him. And that was a child who found composing pieces of writing very, very difficult, who didn't write in school, who didn't read. And I have to say, some of the best and most exciting moments of my professional life have been working with children like that and getting them to write out of what they feel, what they've experienced, what they remember, and also writing absolutely live. And what I mean by that is they see something, they do it, and you write about it right then and there, on the spot. I could be all day giving you lovely examples, all my little favourite gems of things that kids have come up. I'll give you just one little tiny one. One of my favourites was years ago. So a child said, today we saw horses the colours of chestnut and night, and cow with horns as sharp as knives. Today we saw chickens that walked like Egyptians and their hieroglyphics. Oh, fantastic. It's called Stan. So lovely. The one I'm going to read to you, though, the whole piece I'm going to read to you, was actually written by a group of year 5 and 6 pupils. You know, they weren't handpicked for being writers, they were just kids, and there were 10 of them, and they'd just seen a sheep being sheared for the very, very first time, and they were incredibly, incredibly excited. And we sat down in a circle, and we wrote this in 20 minutes, and I have only changed the punctuation. I have not changed the word. A sheep, like a dirty rain cloud, sits uncomfortably, squashed between the shearer's knees, her fine face floating, not quite part of her somehow. The electric bee buzz of the clippers bites into her greasy belly wool, sweeps up and over her popped-out thigh. The fleece falls like pearly cake mix, and underneath is cream, pale as yogurt. Up the ribcage, along the back, in long arcs like rainbows, gently around the delicate neck. the clippers slice old from new. The sheep's eyes stare wide as an owl's. She vaguely remembers this feeling of lightness and cooler skin. It means juicy grass and sunshine. And now it's finished. She leaps onto her stick-like legs and pointy ballerina toes to find she's nude, naked, almost human in her pink skin. Now, what the kids got out of that was a lot more than a nice bit of writing. The process of writing about what they had just experienced heightened that experience for them. It made the experience as clear and as deep as water in a well. Not only will they never forget that sheep, but they'll never forget the power that they felt in putting their experience into words and seeing it there. Played back to them and played back to the other children around them so that their experience was immediately translated into something that somebody else could grasp and understand. That I would argue, actually, that that process of experiencing, internalising and expressing to other human beings is what we're for. You know, if human beings are for anything, that's what we're for. We're for explaining what our world is and expressing it to other human beings. Now, I think that when the children were creating that piece, they were in a real dialogue with the world. A real, proper conversation with the world around them, which is absolutely fundamentally what we want for our kids, isn't it? That's what you want. You want them to be in the world, relating to it, in a dialogue with it. And that's what they were experiencing in that process of creating that piece. They were totally in that synaptic fizz zone that I was talking about earlier. Now, of course, that I would argue that that kind of creative fire, once lit, doesn't really ever grow out, not without an awful lot of dousing. And I think, however briefly that flame burns for children, it changes the internal, emotional, neurological landscape absolutely irreversibly and forever. But I can't prove it to you. I absolutely can't prove it to you. So I'm going to finish by just returning to my walk over Vauxhall Bridge to my publisher with On Westminster Bridge, that wonderful piece of observational non-fiction called A Poem going round in my head. Those words engage me. They get my brain and my soul into gear, ready for forward motion, ready to do something new. I absorb and I enjoy once again that vision of 19th century London. But through my ability to absorb that vision, my ability to see 21st century Vauxhall Bridge is really enhanced. I look down at the water and I notice more things. I notice that the cormorant's got an extra bit of white on its cheek. I notice maybe that one of the ducks has molted its flight feathers. I notice that the light on the river reminds me of fishing on the canal when I was six with my dad. Through experiencing somebody else's reality, my ability to experience my own reality is truly, truly enhanced.